On Friday, September 28th, the Norris Group proudly presents its 11th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, tech disruption, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event is not possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club, Inland Empire Real Estate Investment Club, Think Realty, Wilson Investment Properties, Coach Fullerton, First Lending Solutions, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, MVT Productions, and Realty 411. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information and see Amazon Prime or YouTube for past events.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Jordan Levine. Jordan is a senior economist at the California Association of Realtors, a statewide trade organization of real estate professionals with more than 190,000 members. As senior economist at CAR, Jordan analyzes housing market conditions, macroeconomic trends, public policy issues through the use of external data from the public and private sector and from survey research studies conducted by CAR. He contributes frequently to CAR's market analysis articles, Housing Matters blog, Market Snapshot, and has written various topics, including housing supply, distress sales, housing tax policy, housing affordability, and many other subjects relevant to the real estate industry. Jordan, we welcome you to our show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You know, if you're out there speaking, you and I do that. The big concern is slowing sales. So what's your take on that? Are you concerned, and what percentage are sales down?
Yeah, I'm definitely concerned. I think that, you know, we want sales to be going the opposite direction, especially when you think about it from a home ownership standpoint or just folks getting their foot on the property ladder. And in July, we had another decline of about 3.4% on a year-over-year basis. That's a little bit slower than what we saw in June when sales were down by more than 7%. But it is starting to become fairly consistent in terms of sales not being able to break through some of these other challenges that we have going on in the market out there.
What's causing the slower sales, do you think?
I think it's a couple of things, honestly. I think that one is the deterioration in affordability. Unfortunately, when you look at prices, they're continuing to go up by anywhere from 7.5% to 8.5% over the last 3 or 4 months on an annual basis. And unfortunately, folks' wages just aren't keeping pace with that. And on top of that, you've got the kind of 1-2 punch with both rising prices and interest rates that have started to come up. I know they've stalled out in the last couple of weeks, but that rise from just 4% to 4.5%, 50 basis points, takes a pretty big bite out of what folks are able to afford from a monthly mortgage payment standpoint. So, you know, both with the higher prices and higher rates, affordability is really tough. That's number one. I think number two is the lack of supply out there, which kind of is just the flip side of the affordability question. You've got a lot of good jobs being created. I mean, when you look at the economy overall, it's still fairly strong. In California, I think we're at a 42-year low from an unemployment standpoint. So lots of jobs being created all across the spectrum of wages and industries, and that translates into housing demand. And unfortunately, when you look at supply, which has come up a little bit recently, it's just very, very low by historical standards. And what that ends up doing is pushing prices up at these kind of above average levels that we've seen this year.
Inventory in month supply right now is at about what?
It's about 3.5 months. Well, it depends on where you look across the state. It's about 3.5 months overall, which again is a little bit higher than what we've seen, you know, over the course of the last couple of years. It's really 3.3 months of supply out there available for sale at the current pace of sales. And that's up a little bit from, you know, 3 months in June, 3.2 months at the same point last year. But we got down into the twos. So it is a modest improvement. But from a long run standpoint, the average is about 6 or 7 months of supply, rather. And so we're right around half of quote unquote normal levels of supply. And I think folks just don't want to move. And of course, in California, we simply do not build enough new housing.
Okay, let's talk about the new housing. You would think builders, if they could build a home and sell it for a profit, they'd be doing it. So where is the disconnect in the supply chain?
Yeah, I think it's threefold. I think we've got, you know, a statewide regulatory environment that makes it hard. So even for those builders who do want to get out there and build new homes, it takes a long time and a lot of hoops that you have to jump through to be able to get those projects underway and actually break ground. I think there's, you know, several years from the time you take control of a piece of property and get all the permits you need and do all of that stuff. And then, of course, there's all the fees that go along with that. And I think that's kind of leads me into the second leg of that stool, which is at the local government level, the permitting process, you know, all the various hoops that you have to jump through, all of the fees, you know, water connection fees and sewer connection fees and developer fees and things of that nature really make it very expensive to build. And that's why I think you don't see a lot of those kind of entry level or starter homes there. You know, a lot of these fees are assessed on a kind of per door basis. And so what ends up happening is they're building bigger homes, more expensive homes to try and spread those costs across a higher dollar, unit that they're constructing. And in addition to that, just all the regulatory hoops and the time it takes to go through makes it very daunting of a challenge to actually get those new housing units online. And then the third thing, which is maybe even more important than the state or local regulatory environment, I think is attitudes out there. You know, I think that folks are fairly resistant to new development. There's, you know, I think pretty broad consensus that California needs new housing, but in just the general public, they don't seem to want it near where they live. So we recognize that we need more housing, just don't build it in my neighborhood or in my town. And unfortunately, that's a pretty prevalent mindset out there. And until we can kind of figure out that piece and really connect dots for folks on just what this lack of supply does for affordability, for the, you know, competitiveness of the marketplace, where you're out there having to compete for these available homes against, you know, lots of other buyers and submit your best offer and go up against multiple offers, is really part and parcel of this lack of supply. And so I think we need to do a better job again of connecting those dots for people and really showing them what's at stake in terms of affordability and home ownership. And what it's really costing us from an economic standpoint, right? We care about this in the real estate community because we're on the front lines of this, but ultimately this is going to become a bigger economic challenge where businesses aren't going to be able to pay wages that are attractive. And unfortunately, California is not the only game in town, so that we can really start to chip away at some of these affordability issues.
You know, we build some houses in California, not a lot, but we build in Florida as well, and it costs...
Right.
It cost in California about $140,000 to have a building permit and a lot in Riverside. And in Florida, I can be done with a home pretty much for that cost.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree with that sentiment more. I mean, when you've got to spend upwards of $200,000 before you ever stick a shovel in the dirt, it really goes a long way towards explaining why we're not building, you know, $250,000, $300,000 homes.
Yeah, you can't pencil it. You're right. And so the guy builds a 3,000 square foot house because that's the only thing, the price range that makes sense. So, yeah, you know, when I was a young man getting into the housing market, the typical track was 1,300, 1,400 square feet. That was, you know, the entry level home where you could walk in and buy that. And you could be a young guy, you know, 22 years old and qualify because it was reasonable price. But yeah, the problem is, I don't know how you turn this around very quickly. You know, because you mentioned the three big issues, and I don't know that there's a realization that unless somebody changes the regulations, the builders they are just not going to change. As a matter of fact, they're probably going to do a lot of considering moving somewhere else.
Right. Yeah. And that's why I say, you know, getting the public on board is probably first and foremost, because until we have a groundswell of folks saying, hey, I want my kids and my grandkids to be able to live here and not jump on a plane and have to fly to Las Vegas or some of these other lower cost markets like Phoenix just to visit your kids and grandkids. I mean, that's really what's at stake. But until we have that groundswell, I think it's a real challenge to get those, you know, state and local policymakers to effectively be sticking their neck out without a lot of public support out there for what they're doing. And so, unfortunately, what you see is that we, you know, keep adding on more fees, the resistance to new developments, which is really what we need to kind of unlock the turnover rate and give folks who want to get into some of those older, smaller, you know, more affordable housing units can, because they're not being gobbled up by folks who, you know, just really want to be homeowners and have the money and wherewithal to do that. So, you know, I think the policy and the regulatory environment definitely has to change, but I think it's almost impossible to see how you get there without getting the public on board with this idea. And I think that, you know, speaking to this issue of your kids won't be able to live in the neighborhoods where they grew up, even if they're making six-figure incomes in some cases, is pretty scary and frankly not great for our economy either. And so we got to get those business, you know, communities on board and kind of evangelize on the recruiting aspect of it. We need to take into account the fact that I think over the last 10 years or so, or at least since the recession's ended, I think about 750,000 people have migrated out of California. So again, we're not the only game in town for these skilled workers and folks who want to work in construction and some of our high-tech industries. I mean, that used to be true back in the late 1990s. If you wanted to work in tech, as an example, you had to be in California. Not the case in 2018. And unfortunately, the thing that a lot of these other markets have going for them is, you know, they don't have $1 to $1.5 million home prices out there. So folks can actually afford a great quality of life because housing is so much more affordable.
When you mentioned the negative migration, that's within states. So we lose domestic migration constantly now, which never used to be true.
That's right. And, you know, it's been up in the six figures now for the last 3 years running. I think in 2016 alone, it was over 160,000 people, another 100,000 and some change last year. And, you know, unfortunately, with the way that affordability is going, which we measure, you know, every quarter when we release our affordability index, is that it's not supportive of reversing that trend, right? We're not going to be able to turn that around when home prices continue to go up much faster than incomes, you know? And one of the critiques that I always hear when I'm out there in the field doing these presentations is that, you know, well, yeah, California's always been less affordable than other parts of the nation. And that's absolutely true. There's always been a kind of sunshine tax on property in California. But what you see over the last couple of years, 3 to 5 years especially, is that that gap's actually growing, right? So it's not just that we have a gap, it's becoming harder and harder to stay in California and afford those housing units, even for folks, again, sometimes in those six-figure income categories.
You know, what's interesting is we have immigration that counters the negative domestic migration. So we have very positive immigration. So people that are immigrating here somehow manage to make it. Now, why is that?
Yeah, I think that, again, you know, when people still want to be in California, when you think about it from a lifestyle, cultural, and geographic climate standpoint, it's still a great place to be. It's still a place where people come and take their vacations, which is why we have such a thriving tourism industry. But I think that, again, when you have such a tight housing market, that it, you know, it goes to the people who can afford to actually be there. And so, again, we're bringing in all of these high quality or, you know, higher skilled folks to work in our tech sector and things like that. And those are folks who are getting paid above average salaries and can actually stomach some of these high home prices. Whereas, you know, it's our middle class that's actually the ones who are leaving in like larger numbers. So the vast majority of folks who actually leave California are those, you know, making less than $100,000 a year. They're kind of in that 35 to 55 prime working age category. And so it's really, you know, the double whammy in terms of we're losing those, you know, skills, but we're also losing that kind of potential to grow our economy.
As an economist, I'm sure you take a look at the overall economy of the U.S. Obviously, you have really good GDP growth. We've got record low unemployment for what, 4 decades, 3.9%. And we have a 2.85% 10-year T-bill. And that's, to me, that's interesting because those three numbers have never gone together before.
So, right. Yeah. The interest rate issue is definitely tricky. And I think it just shows how interconnected our economy is these days. I mean, the economy is definitely our biggest strength right now going forward. I mean, we've got, like you said, low levels of unemployment. Almost every industry in California, except for natural resources, where the oil sector is still kind of on the rocks a bit. But outside of that, every major industry is growing. We're seeing growth in a ton of different wage categories, different job types, and the economy, like you said, is growing. So that means the people are out there buying stuff. Consumers and businesses are starting to reinvest back into the economy. You know, the business piece was kind of the one that was a bit later to the game, but you're finally starting to see new commercial projects come online from a construction standpoint. They're putting money back into, you know, equipment, software, things that expand their productive capacity. And I think the rates issue is just, you know, such a function of things that are beyond what the Federal Reserve is doing, right? The Federal Reserve is really only in control of that short end of the yield curve, those short-term rates, and those longer-term yields are really driven more by global capital flows. And for better or worse, California, or the U.S. overall, rather, is still seen as the kind of safe haven for foreign investment. There's a big gap between consumption and savings in a lot of these developing countries, a lot of wealth being created. And the U.S. still seems like a good bet, both in terms of our, you know, real estate and in terms of our stock market, but also U.S. bonds is a place to be able to put that money. And even if they don't go up by, you know, big amounts in terms of returns, you're also hedging against your own foreign currency risk, right? So to the extent that you think your own domestic economy is going to have ongoing challenges, like places like China or Brazil, where you're not sure if you're going to get those 7-8% growth rates forever, then the U.S. makes sense to park a lot of your wealth there, just in terms of, you know, longer term U.S. bonds. And I think that's what ultimately keeps those longer term rates fairly low, despite the fact that we've got a pretty powerhouse economy at this point in time.
What importance do you attach to an inversion of a bond yield curve? And do you think that's coming soon?
You know, the Fed continues to show signs that they're going to raise those short term rates. I think that they have the cover to do so. When you look at things like economic growth, low levels of unemployment, the fact that inflation, even if you strip out those volatile food and energy prices, I think core inflation is around 2.3 or 2.4%. And that gives them the backup and the cover that they need to continue to raise short-term rates. So I do think that that's a risk going forward. I also think they're paying attention to that. I mean, it's a tough sell to sell a 30-year bond when you know the one-year bond will give you just as good of a return. That really disrupts financial markets, but I don't think we're there yet. I do think that the longer end of the yield curve will start to move. We're forecasting, you know, they'll end up near 5% by next year, and you know, that's not a huge move, but I think it's enough to stave off, you know, a huge inversion of the yield curve, at least over the short run.
I want to make sure I understand you. You think that the long-term bond, the 10 or the 30, will be approaching 5?
No, I think more on, I was thinking more in terms of mortgage rates.
Mortgage rates,
you'll
okay.
See the 10 go back up above, you know, 3 and potentially get into the 3.5% range over the next 18 months or so, and that will help to stave off some things. You know, we've got inflation starting to ramp up, and the investors are paying attention to that as well.
Okay. What charts do you pay attention to say, okay, well, looks like we're going to have a recession?
Sure. I always look at the average net worth per capita, which hasn't tipped negative yet. So that's one of the best indicators. The yield curve is another big one, right? If you invert, you haven't had a time when the yield curve's been inverted where, you know, we didn't follow with the recession. That's another big one. The other one that I'm kind of, you know, trying to keep an eye on as a forward-looking indicator is those financial markets. So I try and do what I call a PE ratio for the nation as a whole. So I look at the value, the market cap of like a Wilshire 500 or a Wilshire 5000 index, which is basically every publicly traded company and the value of those companies. And then I try and divide it by corporate profits to really see how much, you know, that net worth is backed up by how much money they're making. And the financial markets actually seem fairly frothy at this particular point in time, I would say even a little bit more than the housing market. So again, this cycle, you know, when I think about what could cause a recession, because again, recessions don't just come out of nowhere. Something has to happen that's going to precipitate a recession, like the yield curve inverting, or folks, you know, dipping negative in terms of their net worth, which I don't see happening over the short run with home prices and, again, financial markets so high. But financial markets themselves are worth a lot relative to the amount of corporate profits. So corporate profits have gone up fairly nicely during the course of this cycle. But when you look at where the equity markets have gone on the back of those profits, they, you know, a big gap has opened up there, and it isn't all just purely backed up by additional earnings. So, you know, in the housing market, rather, most of the people who have gotten into housing since 2011 have had, you know, fixed rate mortgages. They've had at least some skin in the game, maybe 3.5% in terms of a down payment. They've had to document their income, so we don't have a lot of those quote-unquote ninja loans. You remember those, the no-income, no-job type loans where they weren't fully documented. You don't have a lot of those. And again, you don't have all those kind of 5-1 option ARM products being used very heavily. You're starting to see some of those now, but through the vast majority of the cycle so far, you haven't had that. So the housing market isn't that kind of ticking time bomb element that it was back in 2005-06, where, you know, even if home prices didn't go down, you had a lot of folks who were staring at potentially significant increases in their monthly mortgage payments overnight because they're in the 5-1 option ARMs and negative amortization and all these other technical financial reasons. But ultimately what it meant was that even though they didn't lose their job and the economy hadn't headed south yet, they just simply couldn't afford those mortgage payments. And so again, we don't have that this time around, which is why I don't expect the housing market to be the kind of ticking time bomb that sets everything off. That being said, everything in California really comes down to a supply challenge. And the thing that could upset that is obviously a groundswell of new supply, which, I don't think is reasonable to expect over the very short run. But if you take away that demand component because, say, those frothy financial markets end up, going for a correction or realizing that maybe these companies aren't worth as much as what we thought originally, and those companies are then forced to lay off workers, then you kind of take away some of that demand element, and that could be a broader problem for the housing market and for the economy overall. So I'm really looking for something outside of the market to be the thing that tips us over, like the financial markets, maybe some bigger global economic issue. And I think that could take away a lot of the demand, and that would be something that we'd have to worry about. But, you know, the fact remains that we're basically almost 10 years into this current business cycle, this current expansion. And as far as expansion periods go, 10 years is a fairly long time. But again, I would say that it takes something to tip us, right? And so those would be the things that I'm looking for.
We only have about a minute left. If and when the recession occurs, it's been typical that the Fed reduces interest rates in the short end of the bond yield curve 4-5%. And if you had a recession before they got to 3.5, what would they do?
I think that's one of the reasons why they're, you know, in somewhat of a hurry to quote unquote normalize interest rates, is to put some more rounds back in the chamber to use to fire at the next inevitable downturn, whenever that may come. I think that if they haven't gotten to a quote unquote normal level of interest rates, then you're going to see more of those kind of specialized interventions, like when they directly intervened into the mortgage market, the mortgage-backed securities market, the financial sector, by bailing out some of these banks and doing other ways of creative financing to keep those institutions alive. And unfortunately, I think those things are highly unpopular. But when you've only got a Fed funds rate that's in the 2-2.5% range, then it makes it challenging, just because you have a limited amount of ammo from an interest rate standpoint to throw at those crises.
Hey everybody, it's Aaron Norris with the Norris Group, and we have 3 upcoming events that you are not going to want to miss. September 8th, we are doing Cashing In on a Boom, strategies to make money in Quadrant 4. The market is good, but it's getting difficult to find deals, so why not create deals, doing things like accessory dwelling units, vacation rentals, or even adding square footage. We're working with a bunch of partners to create all new different chapters for our portal, and people who sign up get access to our entire learning portal with over 60 hours of information, discounts, and so much more, and the live event. So you're going to want to check that out on September 8th in Fullerton, California. I Survive Real Estate coming up in September is actually sold out on the 28th, but we are working on a live stream option. So if you can't join us live, we are definitely working on ways that you can enjoy the show and appreciate all your support. And finally, October 27th is our advanced cutting-edge financial tactics brunch. I say advanced because we aren't doing the basics this year. If you missed last year's or if you've never been to one of these before, it's a pretty sophisticated audience. And this year, we're going to be covering a lot of different strategies. We've got an attorney, a 1031 exchange company, a CPA, and the Norris Group working together to talk about more complicated scenarios where you're going to want to know the new tax ramifications or entity scenarios. This is the thing you're going to want to attempt. It's low cost, and it's in Costa Mesa, California. Find all this information on thenorrisgroup.com.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Guaranteed Rate, and Nathan Chiboya, Inaday Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jason Thorman with Coldwell Banker, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keystone CPA, LA South RIA, Las Brisas Escrow, Lawyers Title, Michael Ryan and Associates, New Western, NorCal RIA, NSDREI, Orange County Real Estate Investors, The Outspoken Investor, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, SJREI, Spinnaker Loans, South OC RIA, Tri-County Association of Realtors, UDirect IRA Services, White House Catering. See isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.